This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Reactionary Tree. He is an alt-right blogger and writes for Radix Journal. Reactionary Tree, it's great talking to you.
Yeah, it's good to be here, Robert.
And I'm also joined here with my co-host, Pillator.
Hi, Reactionary Tree.
How you doing, Pillator?
First of all, can you talk about how you got interested in the alt-right? Are you relatively new, or were you there since the beginning?
I would say that I came into this movement probably at the end of 2013. My whole story probably dates back to when the Trayvon Martin incident happened. And I would say that it had less to do with the actual circumstances of the event and more noticing the media narrative that developed around the event that was obviously different than the actual evidence of the whole ordeal between George Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin. So that kind of sent me looking for answers. And so in 2013, I fired up a YouTube channel a long time ago and a Twitter account called The Objectivist Tree, but I quickly moved away from that. I started dabbling in like the whole neo-reaction movement. And then
did you go through a libertarian phase before that?
Yes. I would say though, when I became politically woke, as it were, I pretty much was a libertarian. The very first political event that animated me was the Iraq War, which I was staunchly opposed to from the get-go. And then when Ron Paul launched his presidential election in 2007, I became very heavily involved with Ron Paul and then later the Tea Party.
What do you see as some of the biggest flaws of libertarianism and the Tea Party movement, which I think has declined? Some of the original Ron Paul supporters have moved to the alt-right, and then some of them ended up with Gary Johnson.
Well, libertarianism would be perhaps fine if it were a libertarianism in one country. The problem with libertarianism is once you start inviting all types of different ethnocultural groups into your society, because you support the free movement of labor, and these other ethnocultural groups don't happen to value classical liberalism or any of your values, then that creates a massive problem. In order for libertarianism to work, people have to kind of all agree to the tenets of libertarianism. And as for the Tea Party, the problem with the Tea Party was it was very easily co-opted because it basically just was restating the platform of the Republican Party. What did they wanted? Limited government. They wanted low taxes. They wanted free markets. They wanted to follow the Constitution. Well, if you read the Republican Party platform, it already says that they supposedly do all those things. So it was very easily co-opted. And both of these ideologies ultimately still accept, you know, the key tenets of liberalism, which is egalitarianism, kind of a racial Boasianism.
See, do you mean classical liberalism or the more 20th century ideologies?
I kind of mean like it all. Like I would view libertarianism, conservatism, all these various branches and offshoots is ultimately being rooted in the greater classical liberalism tree, which is the ideas that come out of the American and French revolutions.
You describe yourself as a reactionary and reactionary tree. There's a perception that reactionaries want to go back to a specific era in history. Do you want to just sort of freeze changes or declines or go back in time to a specific era? Or do you have a sort of vision for a utopian future?
I would say that most of my reactionary tendencies tend to be just anti-democratic. I don't really, I mean, you can't go back. That's the thing. You can only go forward into history or into the future. So I would say, yeah, so perhaps the name that I originally chose is a bit, not quite true. I do say I would embrace some aspects of, say, futurism. I definitely am very animated by a thinker like Guillaume Fay of the European New Right and his philosophy of archaeo-futurism. I tend to like that philosophy a lot, actually.
Are you talking about technology or even with aesthetics and culture as well?
I believe in technological progress. As for aesthetics, I would support, I guess, futuristic, but ultimately, futuristic aesthetics that display or channel like a sense of like the heroic. Perhaps like romantic, heroic, greatness, these types of things. Definitely not like modern aesthetics.
I know what you're
Does
getting at, but could you give like some specific examples of that?
like in art, in architecture, in music, so classical music or more romantic period art, or say sculptures like those found in ancient Greece or Rome, or more recently, like by Arno Brecker, that display masculine and feminine ideals, beauty, strength, heroic values in the art and in the architecture. That sort of thing. Does that make sense?
What do you think about things like retrofuturism, cyberpunk, and vaporwave?
I'm only kind of familiar with like a vaporwave, and more specifically like this synth wave, or what people are calling fash wave, which
Oh,
is,
yeah.
yeah, like Zurius or Stormcloak or Cyber-Nazi, basically these alt-right movement guys who are putting together this type of retro synth wave. And I actually like that music. I think it's pretty good. It's the essence of archaeo-futurism.
Do you think it's just kind of a part of trolling in a meme culture, or do you think it's a serious vision for a grand aesthetic?
I would say that it's m less trolly. I mean, there are obviously very trollish aspects to the alternative right movement. But the music itself, I think, is conveying some type of a vision for the future. I do think that you can sense that in some of the music.
I was thinking about archaeofuturism, and previously we had on the show Jason Giorgiani, and he in his book Prometheus and Atlas, where he talks about these future things to go ahead in a time where the current present trends are kind of declining and decadent, very in the similar of the Oswald Spengler, the Four Seasons, and we're kind of in that maybe the Kali Yuga era or something. But I think it's interesting to think about archaeofuturism and the aspects of that. There's a lot of people on the alternative right that do look at the past for advice, such as the great Western civilization, like thinkers, like Plato, Aristotle, even Shakespeare, and they'll look at that and say how grand it is. However, if people role play and LARP too much in that past, they'll say, like, what's the one of the candidates like a Daily Stormer, this Hollywood Nazism and loving Adolf Hitler. It seems to be that people can be stuck in the past. And I think a big question should be taking these things of the past and then moving forward.
I guess hence archaeofuturism, or I'm thinking more of that as current trends are evolving, that somehow, I think right now, I feel as though that the alternative right might be too stuck in, you know, I think there's this thing where people are too stuck in these trends, these things of the past, but, you know, it's good to make people go forward, and I don't know, and you could, I guess, say everyone who writes on the alt-right are going forward, yet at the same time, how can you read, like, Shakespeare or Plato and yet to move forward instead of being stagnant in the past?
I do think the criticisms of being stuck in the past, there's some truth to that. You'll find that particularly with people who admire the old right authoritarian movements of the early 20th century, like National Socialism or Fascism, or the people who romanticize about the Confederacy. Or even nowadays, a lot of people in the alt-right movement, they still, in many ways, idolize, say, like an older America, like maybe a 1950s Americana. And those are all very backward-looking, like you said. And it's good that they're rejecting the current state of affairs in society, because it's obviously it's in decline and it's getting worse and it's very terrible, but there is no going back to these movements. You have to go forward, and that is what archaeofuturism is. It's the archaeo part of archaeofuturism is the archaic, which means to kind of look at the traditional or even more primordial essence of what makes us great as a people, and returning to that, recapturing that essence, and then the futurist part going forward into the future to tear down this current world and to create a new world.
So in a sense, creating something new from scratch that is inspired by the best aspects of the past, but not freezing, not like just recreating a perfect, freezing the past as like a museum, creating something new with the best of the past. That's why sort of the terminology reactionary is sometimes used to describe people who just want to kind of either stop change or go back in time.
Agreed. Perhaps I should change my moniker to Futurist Tree.
Or Archaeo Futurist Tree.
Yeah.
It seems that there's, from what I've seen, I remember people in college or students in college where you have these very young teenagers and they have, you know, they think highly of the first time they'll read Plato or Socrates. And, you know, they will think to themselves that, this is everything, and that the ideal society is living out the Republic or Plato's Republic. But there's a word for that, and we call it LARPy, right? It's a LARPy, silly thing. And it seems to like if you live in Nebraska or in the Midwest or somewhere other in America where everything's stagnant and people are in their LARPy world thinking that this is grand and great, and it seems about that one person becomes a cat lady and nothing is really done. Where it feels like archaeofuturism, you like these things, right, and think of all these grand traditions, but it's not being stuck in this role-playing past, and then you kind of go going forward. I really do like that, and I think there's a problem with so many people, especially in the English studies department, where you have this Shakespeare fetishism, as if Shakespeare is like Jesus Christ, when in fact it's just this boring, pretentious love for the figure, and it's not really respecting. Like, I don't think Shakespeare is going to solve our mass immigration or Syrian refugees crisis, you know?
Well, yeah, I wouldn't throw Shakespeare, you know, out entirely, but just reading Shakespeare and just looking to the past is not going to solve the problems of the present or the future. That I agree with.
There's this whole concept to call the alt-left or the left wing of the alt-right that Rabbit is promoting. And part of it is kind of this mod aesthetic. aesthetic, but are there any issues where you agree with the left on, say, whether they're economic issues, social issues, or environmental issues?
I'm aware of this alt-left phenomenon. Ultimately, I would, you know, describe myself as an identitarian, so I am identity will be central to any type of policy, regardless of its economic or social. As to the things that I agree with the left on, I used to be a libertarian, and since becoming to an identitarian viewpoint, I've definitely softened my stance on, say, the welfare state. And also, I do believe in some, you know, type of like environmentalism, or perhaps it's more of a conservationism. It would be a tragedy to basically, you know, bulldoze all of nature and like replace it with a strip mall or something like that. And, you know, I'm sympathetic towards the idea of wanting to have renewable energies. I just think some of them are just, they're not there yet. So perhaps on some environmental or welfare policy, I will agree with some of leftists in this alt-right identitarian movement. As for social issues, I ultimately still, in many ways, have a kind of a libertarian streak in me. I think, though, once you become an identitarian, these things like, say, the LGBT or feminism, which I ultimately am not supportive of, I do think, say, feminism, for example, is when you're thinking about things in ethnocultural identity, feminism, it just seems like that shouldn't even, how can you be a feminist and an identitarian? Because most feminists, they're not particularly concerned with
well, their identitarianism is their gender, not their greater group.
Exactly. They're not thinking about things like ethnoculturally. Like, if you're a feminist, you're most likely not going to be producing offspring. And so, like, this alt-left, I've met alt-left feminists, like a handful of them. I think ultimately, if you're not concerned about the continuation and the survival of your ethnocultural group, then there's almost no use for you in the movement in general. I mean, in the very basic aspect of the meaning of life, if we look at it just purely through a Darwinian lens, the purpose of life is survival and replication. And if you're not doing both of those, then everything ends with you. And so I just think that those things kind of go away once you get into identitarianism, because it becomes less about your individual wants, and you're now thinking, instead of in a terms of my individual rights, you're thinking about like my duty to my ethnocultural group. And so you're now prioritizing that group over your own individual wants and needs.
In your essay on Radix, the alt-right, the American resistance, you say that the alt-right is the only sole authentic resistance movement of our time, and you refer to other movements, the civic nationalist wing of the Trump movement, which some describe as the alt-right, and also the Bernie Sanders movement, which is a kind of left-wing populism. Can you explain that and some of the political objectives that you put across in that essay?
So I do, when I did write that, I do agree that it is the only movement, because first, let's examine, say, civic nationalism. Civic nationalism, ultimately, what it all boils down to is kind of a almost just an economic nationalism. It's saying that anyone can come here, anyone can be an American. So American then is this ambiguous term that just means anyone who has the legal documents to say they're an American. And they just believe in this set of ideals. It's still stuck in that liberal, classical liberal mindset that, anyone can be an American. There is no like rooted ethnocultural identity to that America. It's just we believe in these set of values and policies. You could be a civic nationalist and you could still then support ultimately the total decline of the United States through means of legal immigration. I mean, legal immigration is probably the greater threat than illegal immigration in the United States, because that's been ongoing. And we can always kick out, the 10 to 30 million illegals, but as we're granting legal documents to people to essentially come and dispossess us of our country, then, you can be a rah-rah civic nationalist, but at the end of the day, if current demographic trends continue with legal immigration, you will find yourself in a similar situation, perhaps just a little farther down the line.
And then, you're talking about what is sort of the political ideal, but what do you think about the argument that civic nationalism is more pragmatic and workable?
I put it more pragmatic and workable in that more people are likely to accept it.
Yeah, that's exactly.
Well, it is. It is because it's not very controversial. At the end of the day, it's just a set of trade policies and a set of a foreign policy change. So we're not going to go and bomb the piss out of every country in the world and try and export democracy to them. We're going to have tariffs on trade. We're going to, cut down on immigration, but ultimately it'll still be open to anyone who wants to come here. So it is, it is definitely more tolerable. I'm not going to deny that. It's more workable and that more people will accept it. But it's also, you need something to change this current course that we're on. You're going to need something more radical than an economic or trade policy.
You wrote The Intolerant Politics of Reality. Can you tell us what that's about?
So I wrote that in response, or particularly about the inauguration events. So when Donald Trump was inaugurated, there were massive Antifa or anti-fascist protests that took place in Washington, D.C. They broke windows, burned limousines, assaulted people. And I wanted to write that because we are getting to a point now in politics where we're no longer having the rational discussion about ideas. Instead, it's that person has ideas that I dislike and I find threatening, so I'm going to use violence against that person. And it's kind of like this is a wake-up call, people. We can't just keep complaining like, oh, the intolerant left, they just don't want to have a rational conversation. Well, yeah, they don't. They want to bash your skull in with a bat. So what are you going to do about it? You have to defend yourself. You have to essentially start taking your own side. And so eventually we're kind of seeing the middle is being torn apart because one side is becoming extremely militant towards the other side because they won the election. They're having their policies enacted now. And you can't have the conversation with someone who's punching you in the face. You have to punch them back. And so it's kind of time to start putting yourself in that mindset.
Now, there's always been talk about it, Antifa. I mean, there's Gavin McInnes's Proud Boys, which is sort of this experiment going on right now. Yet at the same time, I really do think that the Antifa are really a certain group of white people, right? When we think of all the destruction of non-whites happening, it's usually Black Lives Matter, and the alt-right calls it a chimp out. It's usually black people rioting and destroying things. Now with the whole Milo protests and these things happening, it's all white, black-cladded, blacks, you know, wearing, donning white people. Now it's funny, though, that the thing in question is that these whites are usually from upper classes. They're, you know, they're not like ghetto, like the black guys, you know. They're usually based upon ideology. And I've been saying this before. I think the Antifa come from this urbanite, liberal major city, and all these white kids are into punk and hardcore music. And so they really don't do their reading online, because I really think there's such a thing called white people ebonics, where, you know, things they don't like mean things as, like, you know, racist or fascist, and it pretty much falls under the line of Christian Landor's Stuff White People Like book. And I think the Antifa really, they just don't understand the alt-right, is because they think it's literally the Satan, right? They think it's a disease. They think fascism is a disease, and in return they want anarchy, right? I think their main, like, manifestos is pretty much, there's this book by a publisher, Crime Think, Days of War, Knights of Love, Invasion, all the anarchist press books, where it basically tells whites that they have freedom to do what they want, but they should always attack the oppressor. And it really comes from that juvenile ideal of punk rock music, where you're resisting against something. So in a way, this whole Antifa, or even the Women's March, is basically whites feeling good about themselves by pretending to be pretentious intellects or pretentious Jesus Christ figures, where they're trying to do something bigger, right, with these all elaborate things where they say Trump's grabbing by the pussy and there's a big cardboard pussy out there. It's like there's this not a disease, but a problem within whites today, where white people get high off of this weird pathological altruism, or at least pathological pretentious intellectualism, and it's less about the collective and more about individualism. I think it's why feminism is rampant in these, like, all-girls schools or college girls, because these white girls that are, like, 18, 19 or, like, bullied or something feel that feminism could save them because they feel better than thou. And it's this really hurts on both sides. I think the Antifa has a lot of growing up to do, really, or at least that they're just enjoying it like it's really a white people chimp out. But
I would like to see an ethnic breakdown of the Antifa. I would say it is white, it's Jewish. I've heard that the GotNews.com people released the list of the 200 plus Antifa who were arrested during the D.C. Inauguration riots. There were whites, Jews, some Indians, but surprisingly not a lot of African Americans. And I think you're kind of right. It's these upper middle class.
Are you talking about the MBI event, or more recently?
This just was published recently on GotNews.
Oh, the anti-Trump protest.
Yes, from the inauguration. So there were like over 200 arrests made, and the We Searcher Got News people published all the names of the people who were arrested. And it was, if you look, it's mostly Jewish surnames, some like Irish surnames, even some Indian surnames. But I think you're correct in stating that it's more of a upper middle class revolt. But what they're ultimately doing is if you think about it, they're acting entirely within their class interest. Upper middle class people preach, you know, quote unquote, anti-racist, pro-multicultural, secular, pro-feminist, pro-LGBT ideologies. I mean,
well, what is ironic is if you look at the Antifa side and the alt-right side, you do see a lot of individuals who are from maybe former middle to upper middle class backgrounds, but they're seeing a decline in their standard of living and their economic opportunities, and they're looking to feel part of something greater. And I think both sides are in conflict with each other, but you have that same trend exist within both groups.
I agree. It's almost like two sides of the same coin in some way, but each side has adopted a different narrative. We have adopted the narrative that whites have become completely dispossessed of their country. They no longer control their destiny here on the North American continent. Whereas Antifa have imbibed the narrative that because Donald Trump was elected, that literally Hitler has been elected, Nazism is here, and they are ready to fight it. And ultimately, the left, they want this. They want people like the alt-right or Donald Trump to exist because liberalism, they need to be constantly liberating themselves from something. If there is no boogeyman, then they have run out of things to liberate themselves from. Mm.
Recently, the alt-right Reddit was taken down, and it's been banned from Twitter twice.
Well, reactionary tree.
Oh, you've been banned from Twitter twice. What is the history of alt-right Reddit, and where is everything going to go from now?
So the alt-right subreddit was growing in popularity. It was growing very rapidly. I was one of the moderators there, and I was also the one who was organizing all the Ask Me Anythings on the subreddit. We got banned from Reddit because we shared the WeSearcher bounty that was looking for the Antifa that assaulted Richard Spencer on the day of the inauguration in Washington, D.C. But by sharing that, they claimed that we were proliferating a person's private information and attempting to dox them. So trying to identify a criminal is now doxing.
There was something about that guy who attacked Richard Spencer. There was rumors that he was this individual who was into scat porn. Was that proven, or was that just a rumor?
That's not true, though those people look very much alike. I know that there are people who are researching this question, and they are getting to the bottom of it, and they're getting close to figuring out who the person who assaulted Richard Spencer was. So it wasn't that guy, though that's funny how that all turned out. It's someone else, and they're getting very close to figuring out who it is.
In a way, it's strange, because if I was thinking about this too, if you go ahead and punch Richard Spencer and run away, it's almost as if he's going to tell his other Antifa punk hardcore friends, oh yeah, I punched Richard Spencer. As if, you know, we all have this frivolous fame where you say, oh, I talked to this person, I did that. It's weird because in their culture, they think they're doing one, like, a good step if they eradicate one. Like, if you punch Richard Spencer, you're the top dog.
And there's even been articles in mainstream publications pondering the question, is it morally justified to attack someone like Richard Spencer? Because they're saying he has genocidal ideas, so there's been mainstream publications actually suggesting it might be morally justified to use non-lethal violence against him.
Yeah, and I think that's a very disturbing thing. Richard Spencer has never been violent. If people want to misconstrue his ideas as genocidal, then there's just like a failure to understand what he's saying. And when you have the entire media industrial complex saying, yeah, if people hold views that you find too intolerable, just assault them, beat them up. You know, it's okay. I mean, the fact that they're even asking the question, is it morally justifiable to punch a Nazi, quote unquote, then we're at a point now where the media is basically giving the green light to say, yeah, go punch people you don't like, beat them up. If they are, you know, deplorable, if they have very naughty views, just go commit acts of violence against them to shut them up. Mm-hmm. That's a very dangerous situation we're in. And so that kind of goes back to what my politics of intolerant politics of reality piece is about. Is like, we're heading in that direction where political violence is going to start becoming a reality in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, they're even advocating political violence against people who are much more moderate, like the sort of Breitbart-style civic nationalist.
Yeah, I mean, Milo Yiannopoulos is being compared to Adolf Hitler, Milo is a gay, Jewish, race-mixing, libertarian, and you're going to put him in the same basket as Adolf Hitler?
Milo, his main thing is, he's a free speech advocate, and he's against political correctness and censorship, but he's also kind of a shock artist as well, and they're trying to lump him in with, fascism, which is absurd.
Yeah, and also, if you really examine the things that Milo is saying, he's not that controversial. I mean, makes fun of feminists, says they're fat and ugly. I mean, that's not really that edgy, but they're saying he's Hitler. He's, he's the worst human being alive, and he's basically just a libertarian who is making fun of some of the more absurd elements of the left, which is now the social justice warrior left.
It's like, I was watching some Milo videos recently, and before the whole protest happened, Milo will have these videos, I think they're supported by Breitbart, but one video, it had this one kid going up to these Antifa, and this kid goes, "I am a bisexual Jewish kid who had an ex-black girlfriend, and I support Milo." And then the all-white Antifa will go back at him and say, you're racist or you're fascist. But the whole point is this. The thing is, we're entering this weird special snowflake ideology things where things are becoming tagmes, or at least the media can only listen to Milo because he's gay, Jewish, race-mixing, whatever. Well, you have to answer, it's this thing I read on American Renaissance. An easy way to become an anchorman on a show, on the forecast, is to say you're gay, right? Who's going to know you're gay? You could just lie and say you're gay. But if you say you're gay on your resume, people will believe that and say you're a special snowflake, when in reality most of them just lie just to get ahead, and they're just feminine and not and so it's weird because we can only portray messages if we say this, that. It's like Blair White, who's a transgendered person, saying all these complete, civic nationalist Milo things, right? And then she gets all these tons of views. It's strange we're entering. It's like nobody wants to be normal or healthy or some normal value.
I've noticed that as well. It's almost like you have to disqualify yourself in some way, saying I'm, a special snowflake minority, or I have this, something's wrong with me in some way, and somehow this now grants me more authority to speak on a subject because I'm trans, or I'm gay, or I'm Jewish, or I'm black, or any one of these things. It's, if you were to say I'm a straight white Christian male, apparently no one wants to listen to you. But if you're one of these, members of the client groups of the left, you're somehow granted more authority to weigh in on a topic of discussion when you're making a right-wing point.
There is this whole concept, obviously, of the red pill, but there's also the kind of there's like the white pill, which symbolizes optimism, hope, and the black pill, which is nihilism, despair, hopelessness. Can you talk about that distinction, and what direction do you see generally people in the alt-right going in?
Oosh. Well, I think there's a lot of reasons to be extremely hopeful. So everyone should be white-pilled. This movement keeps growing. It's becoming more influential. People are writing about us, they're talking about us, they're examining our ideas. People are getting converted to the alt-right all the time. So in that aspect, you have nothing but optimism to feel about. You should be extremely white pill in the direction things are headed, especially when the overarching political story is also heading in our direction. So you had Brexit, you had Trump victory, and meanwhile, you see these populist, identitarian, alt-right nationalist revolts taking place all throughout Western civilization. So there's a lot to be optimistic about there. In terms of being blackpilled, it's often, you know, you look at the situation we find ourselves, we're still very small. We're having a lot of issues, particularly getting deplatformed from various internet places. So people get banned from Facebook, from Twitter, from Reddit, from YouTube. And, you know, the internet now is like how you reach people, how you convey, how you get these ideas out there. People are very rarely nowadays finding this information because, like, they went to the library and took out a book or read it in a magazine and said, oh, this is interesting. No, they're going to the internet to find these ideas. And so when you're they're denying us platforms all over the board, it's very difficult. And it's like, how are we going to overcome this? Because you want to be in the public spaces. You want to be in the Facebooks, the Twitters, the Reddits, because that's where all the people are. That's where all the regular people are. That's where all your political enemies are, all the neutral people, all the moderate people, and then your people. And that's how you're going to convert the neutral people and the moderate people to your way of thinking by being on that platform and engaging. If you go off.
There was this whole, well, I forget what it's called. There's this alternative to Twitter.
Gab.
I forget what it's called, but I feel that's like going.
Gab.
Gab. I think that's going into an echo chamber. I think you have to engage with the public, with the masses. And that's the whole thing about free speech, is it's traditionally been libertarians and conservatives who say free speech is only valid. And technically, from a constitutional standpoint, they're technically correct. From a government protection, the government won't throw you in jail for your views. But because these platforms have so much influence, corporate censorship is very dangerous because it shuts people down and doesn't give them a political voice because of the influence and importance of social media. Do you think there should be some kind of – do you think there's – what I mean, what is the solution to it? Is it people on a grassroots level petitioning for free speech, or do you think the government should get involved and say, like, Twitter and Reddit should be nationalized as public platforms for free speech?
I do think, one, everyone should just be a free speech grassroots activist naturally. If you're in the realm, if you're in the business of thought crime, you're a free speech grassroots activist. But yes, and that's why I have no time for libertarians or conservatives that are like, oh, you know, Reddit's a private business or Twitter's a private business. And if they want to ban you, then good. You shouldn't be there. You shouldn't say those mean, naughty things. To be fair, I've never said naughty words and I've never harassed anyone. I'm being deplatformed purely for my political ideas. And so are many other people. And so when they say, oh, you know, it's just the free market, you know, the government's not doing it. Well, OK, then you're not going to help me. You're not useful. If you want to create change in this in current environment, you kind of have to be willing to examine everything and not be so autistically ideological about it. Like conservatism, they would totally allow their whole ideology to be dictated by whatever the free market says it is. And that's why conservatism has never conserved anything.
It's a stupid because even if the corporations are controlled by their enemies, there's literally people who despise George Soros but still think his tax rate should be lowered.
Yeah, you're empowering the people who are actively working to destroy everything you care about just because you're beholden to marketplace ideals. Okay, I get it, but if you want to stop that and you want to like save your civilization, then it's time to, you know, drop that crap and start having a more holistic approach, a more pragmatic approach about how you're going to save your own civilization. You need to approach things pragmatically, and it needs to be all across the board. You can't be like, I'm a free marketeer over here, but I really love Western civilization, because right now they're at odds. So I would support, you know, nationalizing Twitter. And if there is an opportunity to do that, it's now, because Donald Trump is in the driver's seat in the White House. And I know that no other Republican or Democrat in the future will ever say we're going to legalize these or nationalize these platforms so that all types of speech can exist there. That's never going to happen. So if the time to do it is now, and nationalizing them to say you can't ban people for their political speech, now's the time to do it. That'd be great, and that'd be a huge game changer for the alt-right movement.
It is kind of ironic, because traditionally it's been the dissident right has been supportive of local government or local law enforcement against the federal government and federal law enforcement. But we're seeing this, like the situation in Berkeley, turns out the FBI is investigating the mayor of Berkeley for basically telling the police department to not act on the protesters, just to sit by. And it would be, and with the whole thing with the sanctuary cities, it would be kind of ironic to see the kind of narrative flipped in reverse, or it's actually the federal government doing something positive and local governments being destructive.
Yeah, it's very interesting now. It's like we've done a 180 on it. So, for example, under Obama, you had anarcho-tyranny. So, for example, with the Trayvon Martin incident, that was originally handled locally, where the, you know, George Zimmerman defended his life against Trayvon Martin. They went to the police station, they got the story, and they released him. But then the White House got involved and got the federal government to push the thumb, you know, on the Sanford, Florida Police Department. And then that created this whole, the whole scandal of the Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman incident. Whereas now in Berkeley, had we not had Donald Trump as president, that would probably be another case where, you know, Berkeley is just like a hotbed of ultra leftism. It would have just been allowed to occur. Like, you have this criminal element that's shutting down people's speech, and the government would say, you know, we're not going to do anything about that. You know, now it's the things have changed. Now you have the FBI, which is ultimately part of the executive branch, which is under control of Donald Trump, saying, we are going to investigate this, because this is an abuse here. This is anarcho-tyranny. You're basically allowing criminals to attack people you don't like for political reasons. You're just kind of letting them. That's the anarchy of anarcho-tyranny.
That's the thing with anarcho-tyranny is people always base freedom, the concept of abuse, by what a government does to people. I mean, you look at a country like South Africa, which there's plenty of government and police abuse as well. But the main thing that's going on there is that the police just sit by and allow a lot of this violence to happen. And that's basically what anarcho-tyranny is. And that's, or even you can make the case at MPI, where what happened is the Washington, D.C. police, they really were totally incompetent, or just sat by and did nothing when the Antifa attacked the members of MPI. And there was talk, I know, about a loss. There was some talk about a lawsuit against the government of Washington, the city government of Washington, D.C., but then the Heilgate thing kind of messed that up. But anarcho-tyranny, yeah, I mean, that's a serious, important issue.
Yeah, it's that the state allows the anarcho elements of society to harass political players they don't like. And then also the state then uses power to go after those same people from the top down. So it's like they're putting the squeeze on them from the top and the bottom. So they'll like take away their guns, regulate their speech. You know, that hasn't happened yet in the United States, but that is happened all throughout Europe. Is they have hate speech legislation. You can go to jail for saying the things that we're talking about on this podcast. So anarcho-tyranny is this real phenomenon, but finally, for once, things seem to have changed, and that's simply because Donald Trump is at the helm of the White House. So now the state is being used as an actor on behalf of the, you know, middle class people that have typically been the victims of anarcho-tyranny.
We touched on this briefly, but what is the importance of economics and class to these issues we're discussing, especially the issues with income inequality and the decline in the middle class? And this was a factor behind Bernie Sanders' movement as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, globalism has wreaked havoc on the American middle class. When you're offshoring and outsourcing jobs and then you're importing third world labor, you are putting the squeeze on these people. You're driving down their wages and you're taking away their jobs. You're crushing their economic opportunities. So, yeah, it was no surprise to see that both sides witnessed a populist revolt. The only difference was the political right chose a better wrecking ball than the political left, because at least he won his primary and then ultimately he won the White House. But I think income inequality is a major problem, and you've been seeing the widening of the gap that exists between the upper and lower classes for the past 40 or 50 years, basically since globalist policies of like mass third world immigration, offshoring, outsourcing, free trade, all these things have really started taking root in the United States. So it's no surprise that it has led to a revolt, and that's a good thing. I think those things are terrible. I think, you know, when a family could support itself with one income, that's an ideal. Now, families are barely scraping by with two incomes. Sometimes they have to get multiple jobs between the two of them just to scrape by. This is unacceptable, and people should revolt against this system. We need a massive reform here in the West of the things that we value and the things that we want in life. And that's what I ultimately think that that's why I became an identitarian, because some things are more important than low taxes and cheap shit from Walmart.
Do you think the identitarian issues, especially issues with race, are a barrier to forming alliances with other potential allies, people who are concerned about these economic issues like the decline of the middle class?
Yes and no. It depends where they're coming from, really. For example, like the civic nationalist people, they're going to get lumped in with us anyways by the left, as we're already seeing everyone to I mean, we have a transgendered person is now literally Hitler. So everyone to the right of Bill Clinton is a Nazi now. So they kind of push a lot of people into this camp with us. And so it's kind of like, you know, we're all on the same side for now because we're against those guys. So a lot of people will, and those people are easier to work with. They're at least, we could have a conversation with Mike Cernovich or with Paul Joseph Watson or Blair White or any of these people. And whether or not we agree on the racial issues, we can agree to disagree on some things, but I'm sure we'll also have a lot in common. Now, leftists, the Bernie Sanders people are probably the most ripe for joining our ranks, that the race issue will not be a barrier to them either way. Now, the leftist who is soaked in cultural Marxism, they'll never get over that. They'll never get past that. In fact, class and economic issues will probably always be second to the identity politics of the left for them. So that person cannot be saved. They're our political enemy, but the Bernie people, the alt-right people, whether or not they can come to us and agree on the racial issues, we can definitely work together and agree on the economic issues. And we're all kind of in opposition to those people over there.
Yeah, you basically need a sort of Big Ten opposition movement against the establishment or kind of parasitic neoliberal power structure. It can include the alt-right, the alt-light, the civic nationalists, and also the non-SJW Bernie Sanders supporters.
Yeah, you could have this very interesting coalition of people to create some major change. I mean, the alt-right by itself, while extremely controversial, it's just not big enough and powerful enough to create that type of change. Yeah, it can be extremely influential and influence these other groups of people, but it by itself is not large enough at this point in time. Though I think going forward into the future, that will change just based purely on the demographic situation. As white people become minorities in their own countries, and they become more aware of this fact, and we already see how the left has become openly hostile at this point in time, they will only certainly be more hostile in the future. That hostility drives people to us in droves. So we will grow, we will gain more power, but if we're talking about right now, yeah, that coalition of kind of these like labor lefty types who they're not SJWs, they care probably more about, you know, economic security and things of that nature. There are people we can work with, along with the civic nationalist types and these cultural libertarians and alt-white people.
I was thinking more of the identitarian movement. I think it's really interesting that the identitarian movement is certainly very young and certainly in their 20s, and it even could be in the teen years too, that it represents a certain lifestyleism that's very attractive. Unlike previous in the past 10 years, it seems to me that, you know, if you were a part of a right-wing group, it would be like this very socialist image, right? It would be like, you know, the big colors, the typical Nazi or fascist imagery. I mean, you know, with the left today, you see just this kind of like Antifa, right? You just, it's kind of militant too, right? Well, identitarianism seems to be laid back, very, has a very Christian attitude, right? If you've ever been to one of those youth Christian ministries where it's like, I'm a normal person, but did you know I'm a Christian? It's kind of like the identitarian thing is like, you know, I'm a normal person too, but did you know I'm an identitarian?
Like the term has a very different image. When people hear the term white nationalist, they have this image of like a skinhead covered in swastikas. An identitarian could be like this cool, trendy hipster, or it almost sounds like more European.
It does sound cooler. I like the name. Also, it's kind of like we control the branding of that. You don't want your enemies to, like, ascribe labels and descriptions to you. You want to describe yourself. So they'll call us, you know, Nazis or white supremacists or white nationalists if they're being kind. And I would accept the label white nationalist, but I do prefer the term identitarian because it definitely conveys more of, like, the ideology of what identitarians believe, that ethno-cultural identity is the central foundation of society and all other issues revolve around that. And that's what identitarianism, and that's what it is. White nationalism, I mean, it just kind of sounds like you just want a nation of white people, which is true, but there's definitely more to it. There's definitely more of an essence to the movement and what it's about. I mean, I wouldn't really, you really wouldn't want to just say, yeah, we'll take all the decadence we have now, but just as long as it's all white, then it's okay. No, you don't want that. You definitely want to have a spiritual and cultural renaissance of your people. And ultimately, that means abandoning a lot of the decadence we see today. If we just had this country full of white people, I mean, things might be a little bit better, but it would still be all the major problems that exist in our society would still be there for the most part, I think.
Well, Pill Eater and I have kind of been discussing this on previous shows, like, how do you define a decadence? And different people kind of have their own definition of decadent. Obviously, we have a society in decay, but I think people sometimes use that term decadent or degenerate to describe anything they disagree with. They have a very rigid definition. Pill Eater, how would you kind of describe what we were talking about?
I think we were talking this before. Of course, we know what decadent is, right? The grotesque, ugly person that's all about downvows and takes weakness with them. Most modern art, from Piss Christ to, you know, Lucian Freud stuff, is it's decadent. It just comes down with you. Misery loves company, right? A healthy thing would be completely the opposite. And when it's funny, when somebody's healthy and winning, they'll call you a racist or whatever, because, you know, people, jealousy is this thing where it's like they have to take you down to their level. It's why also, too, the whole egalitarian thing is quite dangerous, because if one person is ugly, then they want to be measured to someone who has an Adonis body and who's healthy, and they want to measure it up to that. And that's where egalitarianism is like, it's very wrong. And so, however, when we're talking about decadence, sometimes, however, there are people that are for a good movement too, and for a healthier thing. You might, as we were talking about Blair White, okay, we might say that Blair White is living a decadent lifestyle because she's a trans person, you know, mutilating what he really is and all that stuff. However, you know, Blair White is promoting a message to put the healthy normative value to, you know, you sacrifice oneself to better something. And that's kind of a current trend right now, where these things you would assume that are decadent are rather supporting healthy lifestyles. I think a very common thing is the gay manor bun, where you have a bunch of men together who are maybe openly homosexual or at least love the male figure, but they're all for having a heteronormative workable society. Most people will call nowadays homosexuality decadent because it's so associated with the whole liberal politics. But at the same time, it's not decadent if it's progressive and for healthy values and the continuation of a society or civilization.
Yeah, I would say we've gotten to the point where things have become so decadent that people who are broken realize they are broken to some degree and want this to stop. They want to undo it if they can. But, I mean, for example, Blair White is probably not going to stop being a trans person. Homosexuals are not going to stop being homosexual, but ultimately they do realize that, you know, something's not right that's going on. And, you know, I'm fallen. They'll say that, you know, they kind of do this self-assessment that they realize they're fallen to a degree, but they want to make amends. And so, yeah, I would say that I do see that. And that's kind of like what all these alt-light cultural libertarian type people are, for the most part. They all have, you know, some baggage, if you will, but they're kind of, I guess, funneling people in a right path. I don't have beef with them. I really wish they would spend more time attacking our enemies instead of that's what they should be doing. They should realize that, you know, while we disagree, we're not advocating like that you be put into FEMA camps for hate speech. We'll just agree to disagree. Whereas these people over there, they want us dead.
My idea of identitarianism is kind of like that famous quote by Pat Buchanan that Rabbit likes to quote: "A true freedom is not being able to do whatever you want, but to be able to live in your ideal society." And I mean, this is very utopian, but I'd ideally like to kind of see every group be able to have their own ideal utopian society with their own identity, distinct culture and aesthetic.
Yes.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the alt-right is the religion of peace. I would like to see the creation of a multipolar world where different peoples in different ethno-cultural groups can express their own worldviews and have their countries and nations be how they want it to be. Right now, we don't live in that world. We live in this unipolar world where American-style liberalism has pretty much covered every inch of this planet, with the exception of a few authoritarian despots here and there. But for the most part, everyone has an American-style democracy. Everyone believes in democracy, equality, human rights, blah, blah, blah. But that's not what probably a lot of these people actually believe or actually want, and perhaps their cultures, their identitarian groups would like to see their societies organized in a different fashion.
We are at the end of the show. I would like to thank her reactionary tree for being on. It's been an excellent show.
Well, thank you for having me, Robert Stark and Pill Eater. It was great being here.